guest tonight is James Perloff. James returns to the show to discuss an article he did a couple weeks ago I want to talk about. But let's first, I'll introduce James. James, you're a researcher, lecturer, writer. You're also an author of The Shadows of Power, an expose of the Council of Foreign Relations, and the more recent Truth is a Lonely Warrior. His website is jamesperloff.com. James, how are you doing tonight?
Well, I'm doing good. Thanks for having me back. You always have a great array of guests on. It's fascinating, Tim. You can get such an education by watching shows like yours as opposed to watching CNN, where you won't learn anything except maybe what Miley Cyrus's latest antics are.
Well, thanks for the confidence. Yeah, I try to get a wide array of guests and get their views on things. It helps make for an interesting show, if not informative. So, but I try to do both. You went to an event this past weekend, a Liberty Fest in New York City. How was that? And what did you talk about?
That was great. Liberty Fest was a well-organized event. It's basically, I think it's fair to say, it's a libertarian-sponsored event, but they had a great number of diverse speakers, I think about 30 in all. And for some reason, I was picked to go number one. Perhaps that's an honor, or perhaps they just figured, let's get this guy out of the way while people are still finding their way through the Brooklyn traffic. But I gave a talk on false flags, but there were a lot of people there. They had one or two people from actually who are commentators for Fox News, and they had, this is interesting, they had Gary Johnson, who's the former governor of New Mexico, as a libertarian, gave the closing speech that day. I was not there for the Sunday people, but I was there all day. I had a book table after I gave my short talk. And we were all asked to be short because of the large number of speakers. And it seemed like everybody was pretty fair about staying within reasonable limits when they spoke. And so actually, the entire day is up on YouTube. And I embedded that today on my website, on my jamesperloff.com, my welcome page, so people can actually watch the entire Liberty Fest if they so choose and hear a great array of speakers.
Oh, there's a lot of diversity, I thought, even within the libertarian community, on especially on the topic you were talking about, false flags. I know, I guess you were the official conspiracy nut for the event, or were there other speakers who researched the same things as you do?
Well, there were certainly 911 truthers there. As a matter of fact, they had some musicians, some rockers, and one rocker had a song called Number 7. And I said, is that going to be about building number 7? And it was. It was about building number 7, you know, the one that collapsed without being hit by a plane on 911. Yeah. And there were, on the other hand, I talked to an older gentleman who seemed to completely accept the government version of 911. We weren't arguing about it. It's just in the course of the conversation, he brought up 911 as if he completely accepted what the government said. And I'm sure that there was a wide spectrum of views on such things and moral issues as well. There was one lady who, as a libertarian, put abortion and gay marriage under the umbrella of libertarianism, which are things I certainly would not agree with. But at the same time, there were speakers who clearly had a Christian foundational view. But it's fair to say that under libertarianism, there were very diverse outlooks on geopolitical affairs.
Because mm-hmm. I noticed a lot within the libertarian community, at least my experience, is a lot of them buy into the Ron Paul interpretation, which is blowback, and they don't seem to want to, wade into the issues of false flags and inside job territory. They think that's, you know, either too risky to get into. They don't want to risk their foundation funding, or they simply just refuse to look at the evidence. I don't know what it is, but it was interesting for a libertarian event because there is a strong contingent within the libertarian community that is willing to investigate these things, but then there's also a roadblock among some of them too. They don't seem to want to look into it.
Yeah, right. It is diverse, but as far as the risks of investigating these things go, I think it's much riskier not to be investigating the truth, because who knows what the next false flag might bring us. But I should mention that after I gave my talk on false flags, several people in the audience were high-fiving me, so that I took that as a show of agreement, at least within a number of the attendees.
Now, your talk, was it just a kind of a brief synopsis of the history of false flag events throughout history?
It sure was.
Okay.
I had 15 minutes I was officially given. I think on YouTube, I look actually ran close to 19. But my main topic was I wanted to mention that it didn't start with 911. And so I briskly went through the sinking of the Maine, the Tampico incident, which I can elaborate on in a moment, the sinking of the Lusitania, the Pearl Harbor attack, which of course is not a classic false flag. We were attacked by somebody else, but there were many deceptions involved, including foreknowledge, of course, and the deception of our own commanders in Hawaii. And then I talked about the Korean War, how it was artificially created in order to validate the UN. And I talked about Tonkin Gulf, which I think a lot of them undoubtedly had heard of as a false flag event. And I just mentioned the USS Liberty without elaboration. I went on to a little more detail about the bombing of Libya in 86 by Reagan, based on an Israeli false flag. In that case, the planting of the Trojan, the antenna in Libya, to deceive Americans into thinking that Libya had caused the Lobel discotheque bombing. Then I talked about the Kuwaiti baby incubator story that helped get us into the 91 Gulf War. And I just mentioned 911 without any elaboration, because I did figure that most of them knew the inside job story of that, perhaps fewer than I sensed, but I believe that most of them must have heard that. And then I touched on some of the false flags that or deceptions that have brought us into the more recent Middle East wars, including the non-existent weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, the false claims about Libya after Gaddafi tried to introduce the gold dinar, and then of course the false claim about Assad using sarin gas before we switched to from bombing him to bombing ISIS. So that was this extent of it. It was just 15 minutes, and I acknowledged to the group that I could have actually done a lengthy PowerPoint on any one of those. And this was not PowerPoint, by the way. I didn't want to mess with PowerPoint for a 15-minute
Yeah.
talk, but I did cover them all, and because I wanted to give people context. I wanted to give 911, which this event was in New York City, but I wanted to give 911 the context, the background, that this has been going on for a long time. And I closed with a quote from Ferdinand Lundberg, where he talks about America's secret oligarchy. And after I finished the quote, I gave them the date, which was 1937, to emphasize the fact that yes, this has really been going on for a long time, that we have been run behind the scenes by a powerful few, and yes, they have been deceiving us into wars.
He was he the one who wrote about America's 60 families or
Yes,
yeah, okay.
yes. And one of the most insightful books, in fact, a lot of the information I got on the funding for World War I around the time of the Lusitania, and a lot of the background on the Spanish-American War, I got from him when I wrote my New American article on the Spanish-American War, which I don't think any truther ever attempted to really thoroughly investigate before. But I was pretty interested in the Maine and the Spanish-American War. One reason being that nobody else had really gone into it in any great depth. But yeah, Lundberg, if you're looking for a source of inside information on the late 19th century and early 20th century, read Lundberg's America 60 Families. It's out of print, and it's out of print because they want it to be out of print.
Yeah, it's been quashed, like a Tragedy and Hope, at the book like that. They just don't want it to get out, and but now it's on PDF, I believe, right?
I believe I don't think I've seen a good PDF. I think I've one that's kind of not too easy
Yeah.
to maneuver through. But yeah, I think that on one of those archives you can find it. But I got a library version, which was much more accessible for me, but it used library copy.
So you said there was kind of there was a cordial reception. You sensed some discomfort with your remarks.
I didn't sense any discomfort from anyone, but that could have well been discomfort that was just not expressed, because there are many people I didn't talk to, but nobody came up to me and derided me afterwards.
Okay.
That's for sure. Yeah.
So you run down. You start with the. Did you mention Northwoods?
No, but let's see. Now I've got to set myself straight. Is Operation Northwoods the plan to hijack an airliner and blame it on Cuba? Is that the
it
one?
It was a plan submitted to President Kennedy by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It was signed off by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I think it was around 1962. And it was to carry out a series of false flag attacks in the United States, mostly in Florida, that included casualties, but also included a fake plane being shot down with fake victims and presumably fake loved ones, survivors pleading, crying for their dead relatives, which might suggest what's going on now. Shooting a plane down, blaming on Cuba, a series of terrorist attacks in the United States, blaming on Cuba to justify an invasion of the island.
Pardon me. In fact, I've mentioned Operation Northwoods in a recent blog post, so I should have remembered that. But there's Operation Mockingbird, and I just couldn't quite remember if that's the right one. But yeah, you're right, and it was a plan to substitute a drone for a real aircraft and have the drone be blown up over Cuba or near Cuba after sending a distress signal that he was being attacked by MiGs. And the interesting thing is that it could possibly resemble a scenario that might have been played out on 911. I don't know that they used the switching of a drone for a plane, but there are people who think that they actually did that. So that would have been relevant, but because that false flag never took place, it never occurred to me to include it in a listing of false flags. But if you wanted to talk about context for 911, Operation Northwoods would definitely be part of that.
Well, it definitely gave us insight in how those in the upper echelons of the national security state think and what they're willing to consider doing. And it is telling that the man who submitted the plan was, I think, General Lyman Lemitzer, who Kennedy then fired. He removed him from the Joint Chiefs of Staff and sent him to Europe to be head of NATO, and that's when Gladio started to be Operation Gladio, the false flag attacks in the 60s and 70s in Europe.
And pardon my ignorance, but was Lemitzer, was he connected to Gladio? Is there evidence that he was?
Well, he was the head of NATO, and Gladio is linked to NATO.
Right. Okay.
And well. CIA and also the various Western intelligence agencies. And I think also at the time, Donald Rumsfeld was our ambassador to NATO at the time when I got started. So that's another connection. I think I have that right.
I did talk about continuity. I talked about the fact that when the Maine was sunk, Teddy Roosevelt was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, very pro-war active Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And by November of 1898, he'd become governor of New York, and 3 years later was president.
Yeah.
Well, when the Lusitania went down, the Assistant Secretary of the Navy was his cousin, Franklin D. Roosevelt, who then became governor of New York and then president of the United States. And the guy who set up the Lusitania more than anyone else was another Roosevelt cousin, Winston Churchill, who was head of the Admiralty while Roosevelt was Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And then when Pearl Harbor happened, those two guys were now heads of state, Prime Minister of England and President of the United States. So you see that I tied that into the audience. I said, you have a big choice, right? You can vote for a Clinton or you can vote for a Bush in this country. Well, this has been going on for a long time.
Yeah.
And the bloodlines are followed.
Mm-hmm. And that was I think when he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Teddy Roosevelt, I think the secretary went home because he had gout or something. And he told Teddy not to do anything.
Teddy did plenty.
Teddy had ordered the attack in Manila or something.
You're correct. Teddy Roosevelt ordered Commodore Perry, I believe. Not Perry. I'm going to get my names mixed up. But he ordered the U.S. fleet to move, I believe it was from Hong Kong, and to prepare to attack Manila, even though we were not even at war yet. Secretary of the Navy, who was elderly, was none too pleased when he found out. But, it's interesting to observe that quite often the way they work things is that it's the number two man who really holds the power. You know, when Bush was in office, most people really considered that the real wire puller was Cheney, of course. And you know, when they founded the Fed, Paul Warburg, they didn't make him the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. He was assistant chairman, but you know who's calling the shots. And so quite often, and I think in our cabinet level post as well, it's the assistant secretary quite often who is really the manipulator, whereas the guy occupying the main post may be there more in a figurehead position. Not to say that they are not part of the scheme, but quite often the real operators are the ones who operate just behind that surface figure.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's like Paul Wolfowitz was Assistant Secretary of Defense.
Right.
That's you get the guys lower, just below, and they can carry out the orders, and not get as much attention. And it's the same thing with George Bush during the Reagan administration. As everyone looks at George Bush as sort of a non-entity during the Reagan administration, but he was, of course, head of the National Security Council, which supposedly oversaw the CIA, but he also headed the Iran-Contra thing, and him and Oliver North within the NSC were carrying that out, and that might have factored into the attempt that was made at Reagan's life in 1981.
Right, and because, he'd been former director of the CIA and ambassador to China and Skull and Bones, right? And so,
Skull and Bones, China, huh?
Yeah, director of the CFR, and hands in every establishment organization. So yeah, probably fair to say that Reagan was using his acting skills to put on the best show, and I know. He was very affable, and that created a lot of affinity between Reagan and the American voting public. But the same trilateral CFR guys were occupying his administration, just as they had under Carter and Nixon and their predecessors.
That's right, because Reagan, when he campaigned in '80, was kind of running against the CFR and trilateralist.
Yes, he specifically condemned the trilateral domination of Carter's administration, which, by the way, it's interesting. Carter, in his memoirs, never mentions the Trilateral Commission even once, even though he himself was a member and had been invited into that by Zbigniew Brzezinski and David Rockefeller when he went to their Rockefeller's Tarrytown, New York estate. So he knew what he was talking about, but he never mentions it in his memoirs, and which obviously were ghostwritten for him.
Yeah, and I think at the time, Trilateral Commission had 89, 90 members or something, and I think a third of them were in the Carter administration.
There were a very goodly number, starting with Zbigniew Brzezinski as a national security advisor.
And I think what happened was, I've heard a story at the Republican National Convention in 1980, how Bush was able to elbow his way in. Apparently the Reagan campaign either met with or got a phone call from Henry Kissinger, who pretty much read him the Riot Act. And it was at that point that Bush was able to get onto the ticket, because it made no sense. That why George Bush? And Bush, he was nominally from Texas, but really he didn't need Bush to win Texas that year. But that's how Bush got on there. Of course, then again, 4 months after he, or I guess 3 months after he's inaugurated, a lone nut takes a shot at Reagan to impress Jody Foster. But the lone nut happens to be the son of a business associate and reportedly good friend of the Bush family.
George Bush almost got in prematurely, but when you look at the continuity from that Bush to the next Bush to Jeb Bush,
yes,
it's very clear that this family is a key player in America's power politics.
Oh yeah, it goes back to Prescott at least,
right? Yes,
and Prescott Bush, of course, he's the one that sponsored Nixon, and from what I understand, Nixon was able to why Prescott Bush handpicked Nixon to run for Congress was apparently Nixon, when he was working in the Navy during the war, got the papers on Dulles and the Bushes regarding paperclip. And was able to kind of say blackmail him to get his career started. So it was a give and take thing, which shines a whole new light on the Watergate affair. Because if you look in the Watergate affair, there's a lot of skullduggery with George Bush.
So maybe some payback to him at that point.
Little payback thing. Nixon's been implicated in the John F. Kennedy assassination, and Nixon was very, very, very concerned with what the CIA had in terms of papers on what he called the Cuban missile. No, sorry, the what he called the Bay of Pigs thing, which he what that was kind of code word for Watergate. I mean, for the Kennedy assassination. I'm sorry. And so he was always pressing Richard Helms to turn over all the files. And strange enough, Richard Helms wouldn't turn anything over, even though Nixon's supposedly his superior. And so there are some people think that really what was behind the Watergate thing was a CIA coup, because many of the principal figures involved in Nixon's downfall had direct connections to the intelligence agencies.
Right, and also one of the outcomes of Nixon's downfall was that Nelson Rockefeller became vice president under Gerald Ford.
Yes.
And so Rockefeller, who'd been competing with Nixon in the elections of
68?
68
Yeah.
and going back earlier, finally got into the White House, and then some shots were taken at Gerald Ford, and Nelson Rockefeller was really just a gunshot away from actually becoming president of the United States. So, yeah, definitely maneuvering. And again, you see, can you imagine we're talking about the number two man being in charge? Do you think that maybe Nelson Rockefeller might have been calling the shots instead of Gerald Ford?
That's a possibility. I mean, I don't know why people don't, yeah, the name of Rockefeller. And yeah, and then of course you have Gerald Ford, who was able to his political career was greatly helped by his role on the Warren Commission, changing the position of the bullet in Kennedy's back to try to reconcile the match bullet theory. And he admitted changing the position of the bullet to to have it make sense, or at least make it not appear completely ridiculous. So to make it feel like he was shot from behind, even though on film you see him getting shot from the front, but cognitive dissonance, what can you do, So anyway, that's an again that's again it just it gets stranger as you stranger stranger you look into it. But that's American politics and American history. James, you there?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah.
Okay, well, you wrote a recent piece, The Agenda Behind the Refugee Crisis. And that's the refugee crisis in Europe. So what do you have to say about that? What's going on in Europe with this refugee crisis?
It caught my attention, Tim, because the politicians were suddenly voicing this concern, and the mass media was behind it, and it was very evident that there were red flags indicating that some sort of major agenda was starting to unfold. And I still don't know, and we still don't know ultimately what that agenda is. We can make some educated guesses, but let's talk a little about the background of. Just of course to set the current context, we have this flood of hundreds of thousands of Muslim refugees coming into Europe all of a sudden, and the first red flag is that this is an artificially created crisis because it's the U.S. Western NATO-backed attacks, destabilization of the Middle East, that are creating the conditions for refugees wanting to flee. We are still in Afghanistan, which is insane because it was insane to go out to Afghanistan in the first place. The alleged reason was that they wouldn't give us Osama bin Laden. And actually, the Taliban very reasonably asked, well, could you give us evidence that Osama bin Laden is involved with 911? And the U.S. refused, and we invaded. And of course, a lot of us believe he died a long, long time before Navy SEAL Team 6 allegedly took him out, right when the President Obama's opinion poll ratings were at their all-time low. But even if they did take him out in 2011, why are we still in Afghanistan 4 years later? It doesn't make a lot of sense. Then, of course, we utterly destroyed Iraq over weapons of mass destruction, which, in my brief mention of false flags, of course, even the Bush administration had eventually admitted they weren't there, and then they said, well, now we're there to bring democracy and freedom. It's Project Iraqi Freedom. And then we bombed the heck out of Lebanon, excuse me, out of Libya, which had been very prosperous before that. They're actually their average per capita income was $15,000 a year, which is very high for the North African Middle East region. Very, very high. They were prospering. Now they're in chaos after we bombed them into oblivion with our intelligence service backed rebels. Then we tried the same trick in Syria, but the American people weren't hearing of it. We said we're sick of wars in the Middle East. And so even when they used the fake sarin gas attack, and so a year later, after they went to the drawing board, they came back and said, well, now let's attack the guys we're backing before against Assad, and which seems to be a oblique way of trying to get at Assad. And I think Assad himself would say that. So we've created chaos in the Middle East, the so-called Arab Spring. We've seen the chaos in Egypt. It's all over the place. So no wonder there's refugees. It's our own creation. That's the first red flag. The second red flag is the mass media. I was at work and CNN was on, not by my choice, but because of co-workers. And they were raving about the little boy, Aylin, who'd been, the photograph washed up on the beach. And if you read some of the alternative media, it's pretty evident that this was, although this boy's death was tragic and he did drown, that they repositioned the body to maximize the dramatic effect. And they were making him sort of into a refugee crisis poster boy. And just to draw some comparisons, you go back to World War II, to encourage Americans to get involved in that war, they had what's called the Shanghai Baby.
Yeah.
It was an injured baby, but its analysts have looked at that and said it was set up. The photographer took plenty of time setting up that picture, did nothing to help the child. And you go back to the 20th century, the World War I, there were the stories of the children in Belgium having their hands cut off by German soldiers. That turned out to be a complete fabrication. And of course, the baby incubator stories, that what they're doing is they're playing the baby angle. It's good for sympathy. It's good to get people motivated. But clearly, when the media, which ignores a lot of atrocities, we know that there are real atrocities, they completely ignore the Holodomor, death of millions of children in the Ukraine in the 1930s. It went completely unreported in the American press, except for maybe a couple of exceptions, was not even mentioned, and to this day remains neglected. And Gaza would be another example. The people in Gaza have been suffering since they were driven out of their homes in 1948, and no Americans even knew about it from media concern. But the fact that the media was getting behind us and saying we have to do something about this, that was a second red flag, Tim. The third one was the politicians, who we know are only fronting for the bankers. So you have Angela Merkel saying that we will accept unlimited refugees, and they're saying that about at least 800,000 will come to Germany, and Germany's going to pick up the tab for housing them. That's going to be a horrific impact on their economy. And see David Cameron saying they'll take 20,000, and Hillary's calling for 65,000 here. And it's obvious that it's across the board that the orders have come down from the top that you are to push this agenda. And I saw one Russian analyst making a good point on a YouTube interview that this is contrary to previous protocols. It used to be that if immigrants came to a European country, you'd have to get permission, you'd have to show your papers. You didn't demand anything. You had to humbly ask permission to immigrate. And now it's suddenly, it's got to happen. It's going to happen. It's going to happen en masse. So that's a fourth red flag. And the fifth one is the fact that it's not, despite the picture of the little boy Aylin, we're not seeing a lot of children, elderly, or families. We're mostly seeing young men of military recruiting age. That's the fifth red flag. So all of these things say to me, Tim, cumulative red flag, this is worth paying attention to. Something is in the works.
You're saying it's some sort of destabilization plan, demographic warfare going on here? They're just trying to upset things in the host countries?
Well, I think that actually that is true historically. I mentioned this in my book, Truth is a Lonely Warrior, and I even quoted the passage in the blog post. I talked a little about the fact that the reason that immigration is so integral to the New World Order is that when you bring in massive numbers of immigrants and change the demographics, it fragmentizes the nation. And as you know, what they're trying to do is they're trying to unify all nations into a one-world government. That's their ultimate goal. That was their goal with the League of Nations, was a stepping stone towards that. The UN was is still is a stepping stone towards that. But because nations, it's so hard to unite them under a single global body still, they have these regional developments. So you had the common market turn into the EU with its EU currency and its EU laws and its EU ambassadors. That's a regional step. And NAFTA, they've been working for years to try to turn NAFTA into a North American Union as another regional step towards that. But in order to give up for countries to give up their sovereignty, it's easier to do that if you bring in large numbers of immigrants. So for example, in France, if all the people are French, they speak French and they eat French cuisine and they salute the French flag and they've got French family roots and so forth, it's going to be harder to absorb France into a body like the EU or a global government. But if you bring in millions and millions of immigrants who don't speak French but speak Arabic, who don't identify as Frenchmen, who don't feel any allegiance to the flag, now the whole country is fragmented and divided. Now it no longer solidly identifies itself as the nation of France. And therefore, it's easier to, it's a divide and conquer principle. You divide it and then you conquer it. That's essentially the historical plan, although I believe that this newest development has to be bringing this up to a new level.
It looks like we're in a period of intensification for some reason or another.
Well, what concerns me is, and by the way, I mentioned this in the article, and I should probably just mention this as a disclaimer. I am not anti-immigration. My wife is an immigrant, and obviously, most Americans are either immigrants or descended from immigrants. And any country has the right to bring immigrants in and ought to if sometimes we need immigrants to fill certain types of jobs and so forth. So I'm not anti-immigration at all. But what I'm pointing out is that the power elite, the Illuminati, have their own reasons and agenda, their own purpose behind these mass movements, which is to divide and conquer, to fragmentize nations. But my concern, Tim, for this is with all this ISIS warfare going on in the Middle East and all these recruiting age young males coming into Europe. And by the way, they're coming into America as well. I have a clip there embedded in the article. It's from InfoWars. And it's a good clip. It talks about the fact that this clip is older than this refugee crisis. It points out that for some years now, the DHS has been quietly busing about 100,000 Muslim immigrants into the United States each year. And this has been done on the quiet, but it has been going on. And it's ironic because DHS was actually initially set up, the public pretext was to protect us supposedly from Muslims who are attacking us on 9/11. So it's kind of ironic that they're busing 100,000 Muslims into our country per year. But it would seem to be setting up a potential terrorist situation, or a situation where we might actually have a battleground on our own homeland and on Europe's homeland. Because, first of all these immigrants coming into Europe, they're going to start to compete for jobs. There's going to be tension. They speak a different language. Why aren't they going to Muslim countries, which where they share the same ethnicity, or a similar ethnicity, the same language, a similar, more similar culture, but instead they're going into a very different environment. And I think there's a genuine danger here that, of course, we all remember the Charlie Hebdo incident and the tensions that created and the martial law state it created in France, that were increasing the potential for intelligence services of this or foreign countries to pull off a 9/11 type event, or maybe something against the Muslims. you know, such as blowing up the Dome of the Rock, a holy Muslim shrine, and blaming it on the West, and getting fighting going, not in the Middle East, but right here on our own home turf or in Europe between Muslims and Americans. And this would accomplish a number of things. It would create chaos out of which the New World Order could more easily be born. It would also create a pretext for martial law, which has been a major concern, especially during this Jade Helm summer, when we've seen so much military equipment being moved about the United States. But I also have a concern, which is a little bit distinct from this, that there may be a Zionist hand at work here. As you're aware, Palestinians have been brutally punished for years by Islam and, by Israel and its settlements, its aggressive expansion, its illegal expansion, I might add, violating its UN mandates under which it was established many, many times. And one of the concerns I have is that if warfare broke out openly in the streets between Muslims, displaced Muslims in America and Europe, and our own people and the people of Europe, Israel might look on that as an opportune time to send its tanks forward into the Middle East, which is already destabilized. They've already got Gaddafi out of the way, Hussein out of the way. They're trying to get Assad out of the way. They're trying to, as my friend Kevin Barrett puts it, balkanize the Middle East, turn it into these small, divided, chaotic little states. But the Israeli military is one of the world's most powerful now, and they would be in a position to go forward, but they'd probably want to get approval first. They probably wouldn't want to make that move unless they had approval from America and Europe, and it would be a lot easier to get that if we were already in some kind of at-war state with Muslims on our home turf. Then Israel could expand to its plan of what has been documented as Greater Israel, and say, well, look, like the dancing Israelis, hey, your problem is our problem. We're just fighting the same guys you are. We're fighting your war for you. That type of a deal. So there are a number of potential elements here, but I am definitely concerned that we're going to see ensuing chaos and violence as a result. Well, there's already reports of on average of more than 50 handbags a day being stolen in Germany by migrants, and women being stalked and even raped in Germany. So tensions are already starting to brew.
Yeah, whenever you have a an upheaval like this, and a lot of single males, particularly unemployed single males, being finding their way or you know, finding their way into a part of a country, you have this problem of crime and, you know, rapes and stuff, you know, things that come with this large infusion of people. And but that is easily foreseeable, and it's very likely that such turmoil and fighting is part of the plan. Problem, reaction, solution, right?
Exactly. And I think that actually Putin put it very well in his UN speech. He said that the proper solution is to stabilize these people's homelands in the Middle East. And hopefully that's what the Russian aircraft are trying to do now. It seems like what they're trying to do. And the ideal situation is to let these people not transplant them to Europe, but to stay in their native homes where they've lived for decades. And historically for many, many centuries, mm-hmm. thousands of years. So why displace them on a permanent basis to countries like Germany and Sweden? Why shouldn't we just make things peaceful in the Middle East and let them stay at home? That is obviously the correct solution, no doubt about it.
But, you know, that would conflict with the policy objectives of NATO, Western nations,
yes.
Israel, because their policy is destabilization and war in those regions for any number of reasons, whether it's disrupting pipeline deals. I mean, Assad, Syria, was considering a pipeline deal that conflicted with the Anglo-American Empire interests. So he was targeted. That's one of the reasons why. One of the reasons is also the Assad regime. Syria is sort of a nominal ally of Russia and Iran. in that area. So they're kind of a stumbling block to the Anglo-American bloc and the Israeli interests in that region of the world. I saw an interesting video. I think you posted it. It's like with the that young lady goes by the name Syrian Girl.
Yes,
Yeah.
yeah, and she's really does a number on the New World Order, which
She had,
shows you, by the
yeah.
way, that conspiracy theorists are not limited to America. But she talks about the fact that Syria is unpopular for many reasons, including the fact that they have no Rothschild central bank, they have laws against GMOs. As you mentioned, she mentioned that they have natural gas as well as oil offshore, and they don't take loans from the IMF. So, and by the way, there, I don't think she mentioned this, but also on the map that was originally drawn out for Greater Israel in the Zionist scheme of things, Syria is to be part of Greater Israel. So Syria is standing in the way of that. That's something else I mentioned in the blog post, was that the massive movement of Muslims out of the Middle East would be favorable to the Zionist vision of a greater Israel. Basically, you're evacuating the territory of people they regard as undesirable, much as they push the Palestinians out of their homes.
And she made in that video, she made, also made an interesting point regarding Syria, how within Syria they have these they don't have any of these corporate brand names that we have in the West, chain large chains like clothing stores, or they have these small shops
Right.
that do this stuff. So they're outside this corporate, this global octopus, global corporate global octopus that seems to be in, enveloping the world. And so those, it's my, there are many reasons why, but that's not, they're outside this, outside the sphere of control. And so it's, although it's, you could say it's token resistance, it is resistance.
Yeah, and can't you just see a Rockefeller or Rothschild pounding his, or a Kissinger pounding his
Yeah.
fist at a meeting of the Trilateral Commission or the Bilderberger, saying, "Why is Syria still there? We've got to take them down." It becomes clear when you look at the qualities this nation has, why they have been so eager to get rid of Assad and to destabilize Syria. There are many good things about it. It's a country, and
I heard her
both
say,
patriotic, yeah,
I heard her
patriotic America. Yeah, I'm sorry.
her say there are no GMOs, and even their pop soda, the soda pop is uses real cane sugar, not high fructose corn syrup.
You're making me want to move there if there wasn't getting bombed to smithereens right now. It sounds like
Well,
a pretty good country to live in if it had been left in peace.
I think most places are. I mean, I'm not a big fan of politicians and dictators in general, but I just don't think it's the job of the United States to go out and knock down dictators. But on balance, though, if you let people live in peace and work, and they're going to accumulate capital and live fairly comfortable lives, and that's apparently that was what was destroyed in Syria.
Yeah, so like we were talking earlier about the prosperity that Libya enjoyed before we bombed it, and it's very clear we're being run by the bad guys. Our foreign policy is, and what we want prosperity here at home, and we want prosperity for people overseas. We want this world to be at peace. There is no need for there hasn't been one good war we've fought in the Middle East. There's not one war we fought that was necessary. Where they're saying next year there'll be no Social Security increase, but plenty of trillions for wars, huh?
And like I said, I'm not a big fan of Social Security, but if I'd rather have that than the wars, but it's that's what's happening over there. I mean, the reason why you have the this whole ISIS thing is just absurd, because if you do your homework on ISIS, you find out it's being funded by the Gulf states and NATO and CIA, Western powers. It's a creation of the Western powers to destabilize. So it makes no sense. Well, it does make sense, but obviously the U.S. policy is to go in supposedly bombing ISIS. Of course, on the pretext of bombing ISIS, we're destroying Syrian infrastructure. Who does that help?
Exactly. It's pretty hard to find a product that says made in the USA these days, but ISIS definitely has made in the USA stamped all over them.
That's one of our major exports these days, unfortunately.
Yeah,
Destabilization.
terrorism, war, and destabilization, right? Those are high on our export list. I guess our trade balance isn't quite as bad as I thought.
And inflation. debt. So.
Oh, sure. Definitely the government says it's 1.7% inflation, and unemployment's what, about 5%? So yeah, we're doing good. We're healthy. I mean, everybody's working, and there's almost zero inflation. So we're in good shape. And CDs have paid tremendous interest rates these days. You know, just put savings in the bank, and you know, you can save up retirement. You'll do well.
But if you go back to Europe, what's going on over there? Honestly, Europe itself has been under a psychological warfare for decades, going back, you know, probably right after World War II. They've had low birth rates, the native Europeans, and so they've had to bring in workers to fill the gaps there. And you've had a demographic problem in Europe for decades. That coupled with their social welfare systems, that's a time bomb, demographic time bomb. So they really can't afford it anymore. This is only adds to the strain. If you're having, a birth rate of, below replacement level, something's going to fill the vacuum in Europe. So if you go to Italy and France, very low birth rates, and that just aggravates the problem there, because you bring in immigrants who have very high birth rates, and that's as to the tension. But it's interesting to me, this seems very similar to you've heard of the Kalergi plan.
I probably have, but remind me, please.
Well, the Kalergi plan was something that was proposed 1920s 1930s, and I forget from my notes, it was basically he came up with the idea that it was Count Kalergi. It was called, I think he wrote it in his book, Practical Idealism. And his idea was called the Genocide of the Peoples of Europe. It was called the Pan-European Movement. And it was to do away with all restrictions on immigration and to promote third world immigration. The idea was to bring in what he considered lower humans, subhumans. Remember, these are his view of the world, and to promote what he called miscegenation, and this would create a weaker people, which would make him easier for the people of Europe to make it for the elite to control them.
And that sounds very much in accord with their plan.
Yeah. Now, I think obviously I don't necessarily think that it's miscegenation for interracial, but I do think there's a cultural agenda going on there where you break apart a host culture, a strong host culture, and you break apart the idea of ethnicity and country. If you break that idea, you make the country, you make the nation, as you said earlier, make it easier to destroy the concept of a nation.
That's right, because sovereignty is inherently tied into the national identity.
Identity, yeah.
And when you have all kinds of immigrants coming in en masse, with different religion, different language, and as we were saying, all of a sudden that sovereignty becomes weakened, and then it becomes much easier to incorporate into the global state, the world government, which, as we know, is a prescription for tyranny. It's a concentration of all political power into one government, no competitor. It's the exact opposite of the founding principles of America, which were balance of powers, checks and balances, not just a executive branch, but a legislative branch, and a check and a balance between the House and a Senate, and a further check from the judiciary, and a further check from the state governments and the state power. And so you put all kinds of checks on power. You never want to concentrate it, but that's what world government is. Mm-hmm. It is the concentration of power in one place, which, of course, the Bible does talk about. A ruler called the Antichrist, who would, no one can buy or sell without his mark. That is world government that it's talking about. It says he would rule over every nation and people. So that would be a world government to govern the world, as the Bible says he would do. You have to have a world government. And that's, of course, he's a satanic figure. So it's not surprising that you have these same people that are in favor of world government being out at Bohemian Grove, taking part in the crisis of care ritual, and where they have a mock human sacrifice. So some people even say it's a real human sacrifice taking place. So we're definitely looking at a Luciferian evil agenda unfolding You and I have talked about the ideals that we'd like, the peace and the prosperity. They use words like that. That the problem is that we really mean it. They don't.
Well, it's like, you'd think that if you had leaders who had the people's interest at heart, best interest at heart, they'd want a population that was healthy, intelligent, well-informed. But they don't want that. They want a weak, sick population that's either too frightened or too confused to pose any challenge or ask any questions to their authority and power and their elite status. You know, so it's how oligarchs look at the world. It's an oligarchic vision of the world. And but when you're talking about these things with race and nation, people automatically accuse you of being a Nazi or something because Hitler addressed those matters at some point. But that's like, that's like saying, Hitler liked dogs, therefore if you like dogs, you're Hitler, So, it's a failure of logic there. But it's difficult for Americans because Americans of what is a propositional nation, they say, where – America is a nation of immigrants, and it's an idea, but not a nation. So Americans have a very different idea of what a nation is. In fact, the United States is not supposed to be a nation. It's supposed to be a confederation of sovereign states that granted some power to a general government. so the notion of American nation really, that was – they even said the American nation was forged in the fires of the Civil War, the so-called American Civil War. Well, yeah, it was in a way because – the so-called Civil War, destroyed the old republic, which was a confederation of independent states, sovereign states. So even the language they use kind of tells us what really went on there. But what you say, the overall plan is if you do destroy a group's cultural identity, you make them much easier to control, to manipulate, to be subjected to social engineering. Because they no longer have any ethnic identity, their culture or religion, and they start to be melded into this global, globulin corporate monstrosity where we all go to McDonald's, we all buy clothes from the same few stores, we all go to shop at Walmart, and that seems to be what seems to be going in this country and abroad as well. So.
Right. That is definitely part of it. It's not only political consolidation, but it's the corporate consolidation. And so you've got the, Dunkin' Donuts coming in and knocking out the local coffee shop. And you've got Walmart coming in and knocking out the local department store. And CVS comes in and knocks out the local pharmacy. And then we become run by these corporations, which are multinational. And as you're saying, except for a few places like Syria, also dominate overseas, and that's another way of consolidating the world. And of course, another one is the religious consolidation through the ecumenical movement, which is, I'm sure, why Tony Blair started his Tony Blair Faith Foundation. Is this whole idea that all the religions of the world should get together, and that's a move towards a one world religion, and that's a one world thinking. We're definitely on that road, and. The refugee crisis appears to be part of the splintering, fracturing process of nations to make way for that.
It's like the World Council of Churches, which was a Rockefeller.
Yes.
Yeah. Ecumenism. Yeah. Rockefeller. And idea of the melding of all religions and destroying all differences. And it all sounds so nice. But again, it may sound nice, but in reality, it destroys, unique, independent culture, unique cultures. It's just, like I said, just this old globalist monstrosity. But I did a recent interview with E. Michael Jones regarding the destruction of urban neighborhoods in America in the immediate post-war period, and the rise of suburbia. How this is an example how social engineering was played out in the United States. Basically what happened was the rulers, the powers that be, particularly the WASP ruling elite, didn't like the fact of rising Catholic power in the United States. This is largely a function of demographics because the Catholics didn't use birth control, whereas the Protestants did. So you had these urban neighborhoods that were these strongholds for Catholic power, and that's much the Catholic Church derived its power from these neighborhoods. So there is a concerted effort to break these neighborhoods up in the 40s, 50s, and 60s through urban renewal and also integration. This is another thing where they take integration and take a progressive sounding idea like racial integration to destroy the neighborhoods. And they knew full well that by forcing the integration of some of these ethnic neighborhoods, you would destroy these neighborhoods because these neighborhoods were ethnic neighborhoods. Their identity was ethnic. So if you force integration, you destroy the ethnic idea of those neighborhoods. It would create, you know, what was called white flight in the suburbia. And then you had FHA there offering the 30-year mortgage in the suburbs. And in suburbia, the Italian Catholics, the Irish Catholics, the German Catholics, the Polish Catholics would no longer be Polish Catholics. They'd become middle class, white suburbanites. And they would lose their identity, and they were in a lot of this was a plan to homogenize the country, and it was also part of a plan to bring in cheap labor from the south to fill the factories during World War II. And they brought up a lot of these former sharecroppers from the south and just dumped them into these ethnic neighborhoods, very much like Europe, knowing full well that it would cause problems, because you take people out of an agrarian setting in the south and dump them into a city with feeble accommodations, and clash with these neighborhoods which were, self-identifying as ethnic neighborhoods, you're going to create clashes. And all of a sudden you had race riots, and much of this was foreseen. But that's an example how this sort of idea of this wasn't market forces happening here. This was clearly social engineering to fundamentally shift the country's demographics and its politics to make it more amenable to the elite's plans. It's very interesting.
Well, I saw on your website that beautiful picture of those post-World War II suburban homes. I just
Levittown, yeah.
I had not really thought about suburbia before you mentioned it now, really, in this same context. But it's quite interesting what you say about breaking up the ethnic neighborhoods. It's actually a microcosm of what we've been talking about, fragmentizing these nations of Europe. Break up, you're not breaking up a country, you're breaking up a neighborhood. And you're right, in the old neighborhood, maybe it was all Irish or all Italian or all black, but they would be maybe hanging together as a tight community. But you're right, as you move them out of the city and into these prefabricated homes in the suburbs, all of a sudden, you're right, suddenly it becomes a homogenized, or I should say heterogeneous suburbia, middle class, as opposed to the old ethnic tight urban neighborhood. Very good point.
And then they're subjected to the psychological warfare with the music and the culture, the consumer's culture.
Right, and the television of the 50s, the dishwasher, the brand names. You're right. As I think about it, they would have had their own stores, of course, their own Uncle Joe down this is running a cigar shop, but now you would have the brand names being being advertised on their new 1950s televisions when they moved to the suburbs, and all of a sudden away went the local shop, and in came the comparatively small then a multinational corporation with its appliances for you to buy the brand names, instead of maybe some product that a local guy had made. You're right. This has really been a complex demographic attack bringing about the New World Order on levels that I hadn't even thought of some of them.
You don't think about it. We don't realize. I think E. Michael Jones said that he realized he'd been a guinea pig in an experiment no one has written about, or at least addressed directly in his book Slaughter of Cities. Urban Renewal is Ethnic Cleansing is the title, and it's a 700-page book. It's a fabulous book, but it gets into the details. And the takeaway of this is the point wasn't integration. In fact, it created greater segregation because you had white flight, and they knew that would happen. So that was the cover. A good example is when the Quakers brought up Martin Luther King into Chicago in 1966. And he's in there protesting these neighborhoods for being Italian neighborhoods. And basically what he said, what was going on in the South was completely different what was going on in the North. there wasn't segregation in the North. You had ethnic neighborhoods. You know, it wasn't segregation, it wasn't Jim Crow, but it was a completely different situation. So he ended up going up there, completely being a fish out of water because it wasn't his problem. But it was an attempt again to break up these neighborhoods. So it was all it was never intended to create racial harmony. It was intended to create racial division. And we saw that in Boston with the busing in the 70s.
That's right. In fact, I lived in a suburb of Boston, and we had people from Roxbury, which was well known to be a poor, mostly Afro-American neighborhood. Kids from there being bused to our high school in the suburb. And again, that was couched in terms of, well, they'll get a better education this way. It's more fair. Of course, they always put something very appealing on it. And of course, we all want equity for people, but in the terms that you've cast it, it really you can see it in a different light, a light of planning and an end game, much different from the noble ideals that were publicly given for that.
And it's all social engineering. I mean,
Right.
it's elites treating human beings like lab rats and subjecting them to their plans and their experiments, and when they have no right to do that. They have no authority over these people. Tell them where no government official has a right to tell you who you should live next to, where you should
Well,
live. I mean.
actually, I kind of like being a lab rat. You get cheese. It's just the electric shocks that I'm not too crazy about.
But even now you have now with HUD has the current housing urban has a plan with they have zip codes that are labeled too white, and now they're going to start putting in Section 8 housing and trying to integrate these neighborhoods. It's all and so suburbia is getting it now, so.
So what happened? What we're talking about the fragmentizing of Europe through multiculturalism and mass immigration, that kind of took place internally within America then, with the breaking up of tight ethnic neighborhoods, kind of like a little Italy, or a little Sweden, and forced those people to move out of their tight and then into a homogenized group that can less organize itself against internal government tyrannies.
Well, a good example would be much of what we call the sexual revolution would not have been possible. Probably would not have been possible if these ethnic neighborhoods had maintained their integrity, if they stayed around, because much of the psychological warfare that was unleashed in the 60s with the counterculture movement and drugs would have been more resistance within these Catholic neighborhoods. You wouldn't have gotten the normalization of pornography because these ethnic neighborhoods were the source of the power of the Catholic Church and the Legions of Decency, which put the production code on Hollywood. And it was the production code of Hollywood which kept the moguls who were largely Jewish in Hollywood from keeping the smut off the screen. And it's telling that in 1965 it was the Pawnbroker, which is a Holocaust movie, which is interesting, which shows a topless a black a topless prostitute from the front view, and it's done for a purpose. It's done to introduce this into movies. And it was for 30 years the Catholic Church was able to keep Hollywood on a short leash, because these ethnic neighborhoods, the bishop would tell the people in the parish, don't go see these movies, and they'd tell Hollywood, no one's going to pay for your movies if you do this stuff. But you break these people up, send them into suburbia, the Catholic Church, the Catholic bishop no longer has the same influence anymore. And what's oddly enough is that much of the success of this program was helped by the ecclesiastical authorities. They sold out for money. People like Hesburgh and at Notre Dame and things like that. It's the Catholic Interracial Council, which anytime a Catholic neighborhood would protest integration of their neighborhoods, they'd be treated as racist, and they were told, "You must accept this," And so it's just it's again, it's one of they're taking a progressive idea, and the moment you protest your neighborhood being your ethnic neighborhood being destroyed, you're labeled a racist. And then once, not one thing also is the Quakers would buy up property and give them to a black family. Then you'd start a panic sale on properties, and they knew that would happen. You see, that's the point here. That's the point you have to take away from this. Is like they knew this would be the reaction. And of course, no one in the press would report it as such. They reported it as mean, white people opposing integration. That's how it was reported to it in the press.
Right, but, because of press control.
Yeah, and that's where you control the press. But the end result was these neighborhoods are even more segregated now. So they didn't, so. But again, the example is this scenario, this type of idea, this idea of social engineering being applied here at home for a political divide and conquer strategy.
Yeah, I had not even thought about what you had said before with the neighborhoods. And you're quite right about the Legion of Decency. And I think there was a, as I recall, I've forgotten the name of it, but it was also a Protestant watchdog in Hollywood as well. And when those two groups shut their doors, that is when the content really started to change. And I think it was within a year of that Hollywood started making what it called its first X-rated movies for public viewing, which were like basically those are the kind of things you'd only see in a, inner city porn house before that. But now they're being shown in suburban movie theaters.
Yeah, I think was it Deep Throat or something that was...
I think that there's a movie called I Am Curious Yellow had the first sexual intercourse in it. That was 1970. I know in 68, I can recall they were making X-rated movies, and that was shortly after The Legion of Decency and the other one, whose name I can't remember, Ted Baer of Movie Guide, is a Christian film critic, used to talk about this a great deal. But it was after that that the content got raw. And they stopped calling them X-rated simply because they weren't making enough money on them, so they changed it to R. But it's funny, actually, not to divert too much, but some of the older movies on television that are rated R are quite tame. Put controls on my television so that my son, this is years ago, but my son couldn't watch an R-rated movie without permission,
Yeah.
But then I was surprised to see that something like an old Clint Eastwood spaghetti western for the 60s would be rated R, and they thought, well, this is mild, it's got no sex in it, it's just kind of violent, but they rated it R at that time. But you see what's rated R is much different from the R of before. Of course, they boiled the frog over the years.
Didn't Midnight Cowboy get an X rating?
I probably did.
That was 1969. You watch now, yeah. It's very tame. This is how we get desensitized to this stuff.
Yeah, it'd probably just be PG now, or PG-13 or something like that. Yeah.
So, it's that cultural, and again, it's Hollywood, and of course Hollywood, you have to understand, who controls Hollywood? Who would you say controls Hollywood?
Well, there's no question that it has been, of course, the wealthy, but I would also have to add the Zionist Jewish. If you look at whether it's Steven Spielberg or Sam Goldwyn, I actually wrote a screenplay. It was a Christian screenplay in the 90s that was optioned a couple of times. I mean, not for money, but they tried to get it made into a movie, but they could never get the funding. It takes millions to make a movie. But I had the script checked over by a lady who was called the script doctor. And, this is a Christian screenplay. One thing she advised me as a Hollywood professional said, be careful, because do remember that Hollywood is a Jewish town. And I don't think anybody in the Jewish community would really dispute that.
No, no.
I think that's pretty easily demonstrated by the individuals who have owned the studios and who have, been prime movers in the film, in the industry.
I think it was Joel Stein who wrote in the LA Times that, of course, we control Hollywood, we're proud of it.
Right, exactly. Oh, yes, yes. Jewish people themselves have joked and acknowledged this for a long, long time.
I think it's Neil Gabler who wrote Empire of Our Own. And, of course, when people acknowledge it, when a non-Jew acknowledges this stuff, they're accused of being anti-Semitic.
Well, that's always the game that gets played. And, of course, I'm half Jewish myself, but I make no bones at all about criticizing Israel. But I'm very aware that the false charge of anti-Semitism has been used as a standard ploy to deter criticism of Zionism and anything wrong that Israel has been doing in its very aggressive and warlike ambitions in the Middle East.
Well, it's something I said that it's to immunize themselves from legitimate criticism. If you have a certain group with a certain outlook, worldview, or values, controlling the higher controlling culture, the culture industry, which would be movies, music, film, it's not too surprising to see that worldview, that vision would play out in their product.
Oh, exactly.
Right? I mean,
And
that's not.
I wrote a blog post a couple of years ago called "Hollywood Tricks and Traps," and I noticed as I went back in time. You know how the movie Pearl Harbor came out almost exactly between the time that PNAC called for a new Pearl Harbor and 9/11. It came out in May of 2001 by Touchstone, which I believe had never ever made a patriotic war movie before, but I noticed that Hollywood has this timing, and one of the films I drew attention to in the post was when I was a teenager in the 60s, the local television station announced tonight will be showing the winner of the Oscar for the best picture of 1947, Gentlemen's Agreement. And my father and I said, wow, best picture Oscar, we've never seen this, it's got to be great. Well, the film was all about anti-Semitism and this guy who's kind of he pretends to be a Jew so he can experience what it's like to be a Jew,
Is that Gregory
and
Peck?
Gregory Peck, right? And it was a noble theme, but the movie was a bore, and even Gregory Peck said the romance had no life. It was just really boring. My father and I, after we watched the movie, were saying, how the heck did this thing ever win the Academy Award? Well, looking back now as a geopolitical writer, I look and I see that it got the Academy Award 2 months before Harry Truman made America the first state to recognize Israel. That movie and that Academy Award were softening up the American public for the acceptance of recognizing Israel as a state, the Zionist state. And so you can see how these things happen in Hollywood. And of course, today with the Super Bowl halftime shows that are utterly satanic with Madonna dressed as Baphomet. I mean, it's also in your face now, but there's definitely been a boiling the frog agenda in Hollywood. And you can, it isn't just recent, it actually goes back decades. I found that, for example, Sergeant York with Gary Cooper, which was the highest grossing movie of 1941. You know, that was all about a World War I soldier who was reluctant to join, reluctant to volunteer, but he became a hero. Big, high budget movie for its day. It was released just about September of 41, just a couple of months before Pearl Harbor, just before we were about to be recruiting again. And this kind of thing happens again and again, where Hollywood will soften the public temper. I'll give you just one more example that I think is not coincidental. There were two movies that came out that today are controversial, but they were very pro-Southern. One was, of course, Gone with the Wind, 1939, and the other was Birth of a Nation, which was extremely pro-Confederate. Well, Birth of a Nation came out in 1913, one year before World War I began, and Gone with the Wind came out in 39, the year World War II began. And quite frankly, I believe that the reason that these pro-Southern movies came out was because the South still had a lot of resentment towards the North for the Reconstruction and the after effects of the Civil War. And it's very important to get the South to feel that they were welcomed again and to have them feel in harmony with America at large so that they could be recruited again to go to war. I could be wrong. But the dates of those two films, to me, when you fit it together with some of these other film date releases, are rather suspicious.
There's an anecdote that comes out of the Spanish-American War. I forget what officer it was. He was a veteran of the Civil War, but he was still, I guess, young enough to be involved in combat in 1898, 33 years later. And as they're charging up a hill to fight the Spaniards, he yells to his regiment, just let's go kill them Yankees.
Yeah, I know the guy you're talking about. He was one of the cavalry commanders, and his name escapes me. He wasn't quite as famous as Mosby and some of the others, but actually, speaking of that unification, one of the important purposes of the Spanish-American War was to unite North and South. That was our first war where we turned our military into a police force. And so, very cleverly, I believe it was William Shafter, an old Union general, was appointed to command the forces, but alongside him, they put these former Confederate generals. And it was Yankee and Southerner fighting the same war on the same side, which was really being fought for National City Bank to take over Cuba's sugar industry. But it was also being fought to acclimatize Americans to the idea that our military is not just for the purpose of defending our nation, it's to go overseas and right wrongs like what these horrible Spaniards are doing to the Cubans. So that was that North-South reunification. That was a process over the years of getting the Southerners back into the fold, so they would be part of our national police force that's wreaking havoc throughout the Middle East right now and in the current frame of events.
Yeah, well, war is the ultimate social engineering scheme, so.
Yeah, nothing brings about greater changes in culture than war. You're right.
So,
Because of the destruction of the families, the displacement of populations.
and it's also great for disrupting the values and morals of the people, corrupting the morals of the people.
Right, men are away from their families sometimes for years.
How do you get the boy to go back to the farm after he's seen Gay Paris, as they said, right? So that was so well, James, I want to thank you for coming on tonight. We covered a lot of ground tonight. So you have anything going? Any plans?
Well, I'll be doing more radio shows that are lined up. I was down at Liberty Fest. Actually, I was on a show called The Crypto Show. I had not known those guys before, but they're pretty well informed. And they were doing a live broadcast. They're actually out of Texas, and they'd come all the way to the Liberty Fest in New York. But my next blog post that I have so many that I want to write, Tim. But my next one is on I've written some on Cyrus Scofield, who wrote something called a Scofield Bible, and it was instrumental in changing in the views of Christians towards accepting the modern Zionist movement. He divided the biblical time frame into several dispensations. Does not say it was original with him, but his Bible helped to implement this idea. And the final phase would be Jesus ruling from a temple in Israel for 1,000 years. And I believe that is very much a dictated viewpoint. We know that Cyrus Scofield was a member of the Lotos Club in New York City, where his dues there were higher than his salary as a pastor, but he met important Zionist bankers like Samuel Untermeyer, and he was dispatched to England, where Oxford University Press agreed to advance some money for his Scofield Bible, even though he's not a veteran writer. And he went to of all places, Switzerland, to write this Bible, which really changed the way Christians looked at the Bible. To it being very influential. But I realized that there's more to it than that. Our entire view, the entire Christian, not the entire, but the view of many Protestant Christians towards what's going to be happening. And you've heard of this, the whole thing about the rapture and the Left Behind series. There's been a whole movement that I believe within Christianity has actually been dictated from above to get us to actually accept the New World Order while we think that maybe we're against it. I think there's actually a massive deception that's taken place within the Christian church. I knew that the Rockefellers had funded modernism through things like the Union Theological Seminary, but I think they've also been they've infiltrated what they call the fundamentalist side, and that's kind of what I'm working on for my next blog post. The impact of the New World Order covertly on the views of the modern Christian church.
I guess that informs the theology or worldview of something like a Reverend Hagee or something.
Hagee, Hal Lindsey, and in his own day, Cyrus Schofield, and before him, a gentleman named Darby. They were all part of the same, part of the same continuum within Christianity.
Christian Zionists.
Christian Zionists. Yeah. That's exactly it. I don't know if you watch Brother Nathaniel at all. He is a Jew who converted to Christianity, and he nails Christian Zionism. Have you seen any of his videos,
Brother Nathaniel? No, I have to check that out.
Oh, check him out. Brother Nathaniel, raised Jewish, now a Christian, and I'll tell you, he really lays into Zionism and Christian Zionism from a very informed, mature viewpoint. His videos are short and fun to watch, but really very informative. I can't recommend them enough.
And I think the fact that these people are probably bankrolled too probably helps them in their forming their worldview.
Oh yes, within Christianity, the Rockefellers, for example, funded a missionary study in the 1930s, which said that missions should start working with other religions towards good humanitarian works, and then Pearl Buck came out and praised the missionary study, and then lo and behold, her novel *The Good Earth* was given the Nobel Prize and made into an Oscar-nominated movie. Yeah. Amazing what good things will happen if you start to praise the Rockefellers.
Yeah.
But this is a learning curve for all of us. I learned some things about suburbia tonight from you that I had never heard before, and this is why I said at the outset of the program that people learn so much more from watching a program, listening to a program like yours, than they'll ever get from CNN and Fox News combined.
Oh, thank you.
Ever. They can watch it all day. They'll never learn as much as they'll learn on Tim Kelly's show.
Yeah, that's a great – that book, Slaughter of Cities, about suburbia, just the whole – much of what we think of America was just manipulated and planned and all that. You know, it's not what we think it is, so – television, interstate highway system, Eisenhower is also psychological warfare. It's amazing. So, well, listen, I want to thank you for coming on tonight. In due time, I'll have you back on again. Maybe after you write that post, that'd be interesting. That on Schofield, that's something to look into.
Great. Well, I look forward to coming back and just keep up the great work. You've really had an excellent selection of guests. I'm not referring to myself in that context, but you've had some very informative guests with some unique information. I love the way you go into depth on these subjects with them.
Yeah, it's free, non-commercial internet.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't that amazing? It's not just a five-minute CNN soundbite from some guy who's lying anyway.
And don't have to worry about sponsor.
Paid by the CIA, you know.
No, listen, great. Good night then.
Okay, good night then. Thanks.